meeting, and a pleasure to be back in your wonderful city. We'll now move to our open keynote address, and we're extremely lucky to have Professor James K. Galbraith to address us today. Professor Galbraith holds the Lloyd M. Benson Junior Chair in Government Business Relations and Professorship of Government at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He holds degrees from Harvard and Yale, including a PhD in economics in 1981. He's got an extensive academic career, including studying at the Marshall Scholar at King's College, Cambridge, and served on several positions on the staff of the United States Congress, including Executive Director of the Joint Economic Committee. He also directed the LBJ School's PhD program in public policy and currently directs the University of Texas Inequality Project, an informal research group based at the LBJ School. Galbraith's new book, which I confess to having read and finding excellent, in fact, Professor, is Inequality and Instability, a Study of the World Economy Just Before the Great Crisis, published by Oxford University Press in 2012. I can go through the balance of the professor's published books, but suffice to say that I think his latest work being on the subjects of both inequality and instability being two matters which agitate us both as pension fund trustees and trade union officials, it's indeed appropriate that we have this morning. Please welcome Mr. Galbraith.
Merci, Monsieur Lyon, chers collègues, chers amis. C'est pour moi un grand plaisir d'être ici avec vous, surtout dans cette ville que j'ai visitée pour la première fois pour la foire mondiale en 1967. C'est aussi toujours pour moi un plaisir d'être au Canada. Je suis, comme vous le savez, fils d'un Canadien assez bien connu, et aussi le petit-fils d'un leader du Parti libéral, malgré c'était dans une province voisine, dans les premières décennies du XXe siècle. Donc, la tradition progressiste canadienne est une tradition très importante pour moi et surtout que je suis obligé de vivre maintenant dans une province dans la tradition politique, je dois dire, est un peu moins honorable. You are engaged in important work, and I am not here to tell you how best to proceed. I would like to speak about the larger context of the times in which we live, and let you, in the course of your work later on today and beyond, draw the inferences that you think appropriate. And perhaps I could begin by just recalling for you, setting the context, the condition of labor, of working people, in happier times. Most of our lives, certainly most of mine, was spent in what we might call an age of economic growth, roughly from the end of the Second World War, certainly from the early 1950s, through the turn of the millennium. The time, largely, of rising living standards, but also for working people, of gradually eroding power. Labor organization was much more powerful at the beginning of this period than it was at the end. And this process unfolded in two substantial phases. The first one, the immediate post-war period through around 1970, was based on very large-scale unionization, rising wages in line with overall productivity growth, ongoing technological change, which translated into greater productivity and higher real wages, and an environment of even slightly increasing or improving equality in the society as a whole. And then there was a second phase. After a decade of turmoil in 1970s, from 1980 roughly until 2000. In the United States, the age began with Reagan in Britain, with Thatcher. It was based upon a very high value of the currency, cheap imports in the time of globalization, and ultimately the rise of high technology and finance, with an external situation characterized by a mounting external debt. In Europe, and especially in the Eurozone, there was a similar phenomenon. The variation on the theme was that the expansion in Southern Europe was based on the unification of currencies, resulting lowering of interest rates, and big borrowing, whether by the state sector or by the private sector in the years before the crisis. The whole world for this second phase was characterized by rising inequality within the wealthy countries, rising inequality between the wealthy countries and the rest of the world. And in fact, we can see in retrospect, and this is something that really does emerge as I think about this last book, the 2012 book, after having written it. The whole phenomenon is characterized by a special experience for the rich countries, which had experienced an illusion of prosperity, or even a real prosperity, that was not shared by the rest of the world. In our relatively favored countries, this was, let's face it, for most people, an acceptable situation. Yes, there was rising inequality, but the expenditures from the technology boom and then the real estate boom created a lot of employment, and the effect on living standards was offset by cheap imports of commodities to the 1980s, and by cheap imports of consumer goods, mainly from Asia. And so things proceeded, and for the most part, the public acquiesced in them. What I want to suggest to you is that this experience is now over, has been over, in fact, for some time, and we need to think about the conditions we now face. And a useful way to begin to think about those conditions coherently is to ask about what things were like before the age of growth, what things were like in those decades when my grandfather was running the Liberal Party in the riding of Elgin West in southern Ontario, or when my father was making his way through the years of the early New Deal after he came to the United States in 1930. What came before was a time of privation and of struggle in a larger context that we might call systemic uncertainty. when you could not say for sure under what social and political conditions you were going to continue to live. Fascism and Stalinism were contestants for world power. War was a repeated, transformative, and total experience. Democracy was, in most cases, just an aspiration, at best, a fragile achievement. In March of 1933, when Franklin Roosevelt was inaugurated in the United States, there were machine gun nests on the roofs of all the government buildings in Washington. There was, at that time, no, and I speak of the American experience here, no Fair Labor Standards Act, no right to bargain, no minimum wage, no Social Security, no health insurance, no national health care. There was also no national income accounting, no formally measured unemployment rate, no macroeconomic management. We knew we were in a depression, but the quantitative measure of that experience was extremely approximate. People were largely on their own. And inequality in that time was fundamentally different from what it is now. It was absolute. It was the difference between extreme wealth and fairly much complete privation. And the response in the United States and Canada, the UK and Australia and France and Spain and elsewhere, really from the 1880s onward, and especially culminating in the 1930s, was to organize and to struggle with two large goals in view. One was to establish the rights of labor in the workplace, the right to bargain over wages, over hours, over conditions. And the other was to create comprehensive social institutions that would discipline capital, support the population as a whole, working and non-working, uphold the dignity of man and woman, which had been enshrined in declarations as far back as the 18th century, but never actually realized until those decades of the 20th century. I shouldn't really have to recall this history, but for an economist, it has been deeply obscured by that kind of pseudo-history that we have told ourselves. We often say that the 1930s were the years of the Keynesian Revolution, that they inaugurated an age of big government, deficit finance, economic management. As though some Don from Cambridge descended like Moses from Sinai with his laws and proceeded to lead the tribes of Israel out of Egypt. Now, I'm a Cambridge man. I'm a Keynesian born and bred. So I take away nothing from my appreciation of the accomplishment of John Maynard Keynes when I say that this is, as a picture of the time, completely untrue. Keynes was a political force in England as early as the 1920s, election of 1929, but his ideas in their mature form for economists weren't published until 1936. That's when the general theory appeared. And that came after, not before, and did not derive the great innovations of Roosevelt and Mackenzie King. The Depression in North America was over in 1936. For contemporaries, it was a four-year phenomenon that ran from 1929 to 1933. The mood of the country by 1936 had already been transformed. And we know this in the United States because Franklin Roosevelt was reelected that year with the votes of every state except for Maine and Vermont. That's why we say in the U.S., as goes Maine, so goes Vermont. The great work of Harry Hopkins, of Harold Ickes, of Richard Wagner, and the authors of the Social Security Act had been achieved by then. Unemployment, which had been roughly a quarter of the workforce in 1933, was down below 10% in 1936, if you count correctly the people who were working for the New Deal at that time. Fact which is often not remembered. And as for the economics of Keynes, it didn't become established dogma, official policy, until the 1960s. It was the new economics of John F. Kennedy in the United States. And by that time, it had been strongly attenuated and diluted. It had become the management of the process of economic growth, the practice of providing stimulus, a loathsome word, in response to recessions, and the choice of position along a supposed, completely factitious trade-off between unemployment and inflation. And we think about this period, the age of growth. What was happening to the great social institutions that had been created in the 1930s here in the United States and after the Second World War in Europe? The answer is they were already receding into the background. They were already coming under attack. Their importance was being discounted and lost in the general obsession with generalized economic growth. But they were still there, and they were doing their job. What they had done was to create from a workers' movement a true middle class. They had given the sensibility to people who previously thought of themselves as farmers, or in Europe, peasants, and as factory workers, or as sharecroppers, that they were part of a common community. Radical inequality, leaving aside the race dimension, which was still there, was effectively no more. And despite the effort to recreate it since the 1980s, generation-long effort, it has not been recreated, and it cannot be created in the recreated in the existing conditions of society. If it were, society itself would simply collapse. We all live under institutions that permit us to live because they were created in the century that's I'm speaking of. There is a notion, and since this is a conference where capital is in the title and French is one of the languages, I'm tempted to refer you to a new book with the title Capital by a French-speaking author. But a notion there that inequality has returned or is returning to 19th century levels. It hasn't, and it can't. What did happen? What should we be seeing in our present experience that distinguishes our current trajectory from this second phase of the end of the 20th century? That's the topic, actually, of a new book, which you're forgiven for not mentioning because it was only published on the 9th of September. Called The End of Normal. And I want to just mention four themes that I bring out in that text that seem to me to be important. The first is that most of the world, Canada's a bit of exception. With natural gas, the U.S.'s condition is a little different. But most of the world experiences today a fundamentally different resource environment than was true in most of the post-war period, and certainly true in those first decades. Energy costs, oil costs went up to $148 a barrel in 2008, a significant but now forgotten contributing factor to the collapse. That was partly supply conditions, but also partly the rise of finance and its control over energy. Store up inventory, let the price go up, sell the stuff later. You know the price is going to collapse, but you hope to walk out of it with your pockets full. A deeply speculative control over a fundamental productive resource. Wasn't true before. Second major change is let's call it a further stage in the process of globalization. Globalization gave us deeply integrated productive systems. In North America, after NAFTA, first to Mexico, ultimately to China, following the introduction of the open door policy in 1979, but really developing strongly in the 1990s and then the last decade. But at the same time that that happened, we discovered that the global security regime, which was intended to provide a sense of the stability of the world system, could not be guaranteed by the simple use of dominant military force. The Cold War was a stable period of the opposition of two established powers, both of which had, generally speaking, the respect of the world for their power, expected to endure. The post-Cold War period, for a while, was a time when thought leaders argued that a single superpower could stabilize the entire world. Well, that single superpower, the United States, exceeded its capacities in the last decade. It took steps that demonstrated to the world that its capacity to stabilize things in Afghanistan and Iraq was far less than the world might otherwise have imagined. And while official rhetoric in my country still doesn't permit us to acknowledge this, the rest of the world sees it very clearly and is thinking, what next? What next is far more uncertain than if this illusion of stability had been allowed or somehow permitted to continue. But it hasn't been, and we have to deal with that reality. Third force is technology, a topic which is endlessly discussed by economists. I think has a common sense consequence that everybody who comes into contact with it knows. And that is the new technologies permit the possibility of economizing on labor, of replacing workers with machines. I'm not speaking about the productive area in manufacturing where this is, I think, overblown and largely accomplished, but in all of the information processing jobs, in the vast services sector, where in the wake of a crisis, businesses lay off workers, they come back and put computers at the checkout counters, for example. Sometimes computers at the desk in the restaurant when you walk in. In every which way, looking for ways to use less labor and replace it with cheap technology. Simple example, but I think a telling one, a friend of mine who works for Federal Express tells me that these things have a bad effect on their air freight business from Asia to the United States. Why? They're very small. You can put an enormous number of them in a modern plane. And so the pilots in the aircraft sit idle. Straightforward. maybe not a bad thing from a resource standpoint, but from the standpoint of the mechanics and the planes and the pilots, it's less work than they had before. And the fourth major force is that we built up over the last decades of the 20th century an enormous reliance on the institutions of private finance to generate economic activity, and those institutions became hopelessly and irreparably corrupted. And so the reality is that the growth of the United States in this period in particular, which drove the growth of the world, was based upon the extension of loans for which people should be in prison and are not. And the fact that we have failed to deal with this means that we have vast institutions, very highly concentrated banking sector, that escapes effectively from regulation, operates with impunity, and that has no interest in returning to the model of creating economic growth. So where do we find ourselves in this situation? I think to begin with, we need to recognize that the post-war growth regime is not likely to return. And because of other considerations that I haven't even begun to mention, climate change in particular, it would not be a good idea if it did. We have to deal with that problem going forward, as well as with the consequences of the turning point that I just described. But even if it were possible to restore the post-war growth patterns by simple measures, and here my Keynesian friends constantly say, well, if only the government had done more stimulus, we would be back on track. The weak position of that argument in the public discourse means that it has no chance of prevailing. I try to tell my friends, some of whom have a very strong sense of the, let's say, the power of their own intellects, that telling the rest of the world that, you know, if only you had listened to me, is just not the most compelling position, argument, when made to ordinary people. You have to be a little more, let's say, deep, persuasive, and modest than that. On the bright side, there is a bright side, I would argue that we are still, to a degree, protected by those same neglected institutions, eroded though they are, defamed though they have been, maligned, misunderstood institutions that were created before the era of growth in the 20th century. And if you want to say, if you doubt this, I suggest look at Southern Europe, where those institutions are and have been effectively destroyed, especially Greece. And you can see the social consequences of that on the streets of Athens, which visibly in North America just much less. It's much less the case. Social Security in the United States, again, Medicare, Medicaid, health insurance, these things do matter. And when they disappear, the very substance and fabric of society unravels. So if one has this longer historical perspective more or less clearly in view, what does that mean about the task ahead? I think it suggests to us that we are back in a period, maybe at the beginning of one, so that we have not fully realized it, where systemic uncertainty again prevails, where we really cannot be confident that the long-term future will be all right, irrespective of what we do. And therefore, we are returning to an age of struggle, an age when it becomes necessary to rebuild the forces of social organization that confronted these uncertainties, established basic principles and, to a large degree, preserved us from fascism and Stalinism the last time around. And so we have to ask, what are we driving for? And I congratulate you, really, with the on the concept of workers' capital. It's a bit of an artifice, but it's a useful artifice for thinking about where we need to go. What is workers' capital, and how is it different from the ordinary kind? It is, I think, by definition, a collective and qualitative concept. It's not just a financial concept, although there is that aspect to it. There can never be enough financial capital in the hands of workers to make every worker financially independent. That's why workers aren't capitalists and capitalists aren't workers. Nor, even if that were the case, would such a society be a desirable one. You wouldn't want to live in it. I don't want to live in Manhattan, where the concentration of capitalists is, for the same reason. These are, in some fundamental sense, unpleasant places, occupied by unpleasant people. I'd much rather, frankly, be in Texas, which is where I am. The point and purpose of a workers' movement is to ensure, protect, and provide for the group. This is not only fair, it's not only just and humane, it's also efficient. It's what makes it possible for us to live well as a large community. It produces the greatest gains at the smallest cost. Goods, public goods shared in common, are efficiently used. Social insurance is paid out when people need it. It's not like someone's yacht that sits in the dock for 350 days out of the year. This approach, this philosophy, this conception was the way forward before the age of growth, and I would suggest it's the way forward now. Can one turn financial ownership and this notion, more abstract notion of workers' capital, into corporate social responsibility? That's the challenge that you are specifically trying to face. And I would suggest that its importance lies as the element of a strategy to discipline the corporate form. We have one of the things, I won't go into these details, the details, because you know them better than I, but the items on the list, but let me just pick up one, which is CEO compensation. Okay. Why is this an important point? It's not just because we are offended by the idea that some CEOs get exorbitant returns. And in fact, if you think about it, in the case of certain firms, information firms, this is a form of advertising. Right? It's useful for Microsoft, or was, to have the richest guy in the world running the company. What they described as the richest guy in the world. I'm not entirely convinced of that. I haven't checked the income tax returns of the various sultans in the Persian Gulf, and I can't because there's no income tax there. Right? But, you know, that was useful advertising. The point about CEO pay, though, isn't there. The point is that if you create a class of plutocratic CEOs, whether in banks or in information companies or elsewhere, particularly in manufacturing companies which have actual assets, two things happen. One is that internally they become predatory. They have an enormous disinterest in the actual functioning of the company, an enormous interest in the padding of their own bottom line, right, their own pockets. And so you get a phenomenon which in Soviet days or post-Soviet days was called nomenklatura privatization, or in simple terms, looting. right, becomes a pervasive thing. It is obviously a phenomenon that has to be confronted and dealt with. Otherwise, workers' capital, no matter how much of it you have, becomes worthless when the corporation in which it's all upheld goes bankrupt. And the second problem, equally obvious, is that you get a plutocratic government in which the sunflowers of politics turn toward the sun of money, in which you need the money in order to run and you need the money in order to survive, and your advisors are all drawn from money and your ideas all come from money. And that is, of course, the world that was given to us ultimately by the age of growth. The age of growth and rising inequality. And that is the world that has to be remade now. That is the world that you are setting out to remake. Corporations respond to collective action. They respond to public power. Or as they say, they yield to these things when they find they cannot evade them. This task, therefore, extends to the world level. It's a question of setting standards in the largest countries and the largest markets that everyone comes to accept or to be obliged to accept. Minimum wages. Solidarity against sweatshops, global labor rights, common environmental and safety standards, and opposition to aggressive and predatory corporate trade deals are all obviously part of what you have to be concerned with. For 50 or 60 years, we economists have been, I think, complicit in an illusion. It's the illusion of the rising tide and the boats. The boats don't have to do anything if they're on the rising tide. They don't have to band together. They don't have to protect themselves against the storms. This illusion, and it's an element of truth, but it's an illusion, served a sedative purpose, which is what illusions do. It's a hard illusion to let go. Even now, our forecasters say, 5 years from now we'll be fully recovered. It's always 5 years ahead. We look to central bankers with some hocus pocus to revive the economy. There's nothing else to look to. Even now, every time there's a slightly favorable growth report or employment report, the news people say, it shows we are on the path to full recovery. Right? A sedative illusion. But 6-7 years ago, we went through a great event. And in the time that has passed since, we have seen enough to begin to disabuse ourselves of this illusion. And I think no one has seen more. No one has seen more than enough to be disabused than the working people of our countries who have experienced the conditions on the ground. The question, of course, is what to do about it, and that is part of the task before you. My message is, if you like, anterior. It comes a little bit before. In hostile and unfamiliar territory, there is a strong advantage to those who proceed with open eyes. Thanks very, very much again. It's a great pleasure to be here.